Hey, y'all. Shop Talk Show number 266. Just Dave and I talking about stuff. Oh, it takes us a minute to get started and all the questions because we talk about just what's going on in life a little bit, end up talking about some development stuff that we've been working on recently. We end up talking a bunch about the CSS and JS story that's just been really fun and heating up again for another round of drama and stuff, but in a good way. We talk about mail to links. We talk about using dev tools as an IDE, essentially. We talk about just generic APIs a little bit. We talk about the will change property. Lots of great questions this week. We had a lot of fun with it. So stay tuned. I should mention that the show is brought to you in part by .tech domains, which will tell you more about why they are cool and give you a really good discount for buying one for yourself later in the show. But for now, Mr. Dave, please kick things off.
Hey there, Shopper Maniacs! You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave Rupert, and Chris Corey, I got something for you. I'm the one who wants to be with you.
Oh, so good, Dave.
Inside my heart, you feel it too. Feel it too. Oh, man, I got sick last week, and my vocal range just doesn't hit it.
Oh, I was sick last week, too. Man, maybe it's going around the United States.
The internet.
Yeah, all these internet people are getting sick. It was sucked too. I'm just getting over it. So, but you were on vacation. You're back. Last week, of course, we did a show without you. That does not happen very much. That might be the first time ever.
Oh, let's issue an apology. I had to go to my wife's grandmother's. So this is great grandma for my kids' 85th birthday party in illustrious Bakersfield, California. Chris,
wow, that's cool. That your heartland. Kids will probably remember their great grandparents a bit then.
Yeah. I think
remember mine, which is, I think that's cool and a little unusual.
A little unusual and really cool. So it's like, of course we're going to go out there for that. Take two kids on a plane. Good God. We got it. We did it. It was good.
Yeah. No, I got Dave sang for me because I got to see Mr. Big last night, the first CD I ever purchased ever. I don't care about Mr. Big, obviously, but they, you know, they're like butt rock, you know, through and through.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Except for that one song, which is like, you know, an acoustic, you know, like just all about vocal harmony and hot acoustic riffs. Isn't but whatever, that, it's a great song.
Isn't that just like this metal band or whatever, you know, like butt rock band will just like have this like acoustic jam, and I don't know, and they're not like just long hair guys, they're like long curly hair, right, if I remember correctly?
Yeah, it's kind of like Metallica and like
it won't be Unforgiven,
and I was like, that's the one I really like the most. It's like their wimpiest song, but it's great.
Yeah I want, we should get Valhead's husband Jason on the show and get some metal tutorials. Maybe we'll just pivot Shop Talk into a metal podcast. So here we go. hey Chris, what you been working on?
Well, this is a rapid fire, so we'll get to a bunch of questions in a minute. But it's always fun, for especially when Dave and I haven't caught up in a while, just talk about random front end developer stuff. So I wake up this morning and I'm like, I'm devving out a new page, as I do regularly. So I'm putting it all together, and I've designed like a logo kind of thing for this page. Not a logo, like a branding thing, but just like big fancy header for this page. I designed it in Illustrator, and it's just kind of, it's like typography and whatever. And it's the title of the page. So it's like custom type. It says some words, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm. Says words.
Yeah. And then I export it, you know, through Illustrator, and I get it in, you know, like the view box for the thing is like 473 wide by 271 tall or something. It's just some weird numbers. It's not 16:9 or whatever. It's just, it has an aspect ratio, but it's a weird one. And so I'm like, how am I going to throw this on the page? I could just use an image tag and say image source equals whatever. Like, that's fine. But it's the title. It's the title of the page. So in my old school mind, I guess, I'm like, I'm going to just have it be an H1 tag on the page. And I'm going to have it say the words that it says in the thing. But then I'm going to do image replacement. You know what I mean? And do the thing where I like clip it or text indent -9000 overflow hidden or whatever and just get rid of it. But use the H1 element as a box, and I want it to have the exact aspect ratio of the SVG artwork to scale inside of it, because I'm not going to set fixed pixel value. So I'm in padded box territory. And this is well-tread territory, I feel like. Dave, you have an article, Uncle Dave's Padded Box, that's based on the intrinsic, you know, ratios thing. The idea being you can set an element to like height 0 and then give the box height anyway by applying like padding top to it of a percentage value. And all of a sudden you've got this box in web design has an aspect ratio that, like, if the width changes, the height comes with it. They're tied together.
Yep. So just, you want an image or something to fill the box, to fill a box of a certain size.
Exactly. So, and this is a perfect scenario for it because I know exactly the width and height of the thing. It's just an SVG thing. Okay. So, but I was like, we got to set, like, what is the padding top value? Like, what is it? Like when it's 4x1, it's 25%. You know, when it's a 2x1, it's 50%. When it's 16x9, it's some other thing, 47 point. I don't even remember what the values are. And I've definitely seen some like frameworks that have 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 of those values in there, and you can just reach for them as a class and it'll give you that aspect ratio. But I was like, I don't want predetermined aspect ratio. I have one aspect ratio I'm dealing with here. So what's the math? Well, the math is the height divided by the width will get you that number that you want. And I was like, I could do that in SAS, right? Like, because math is easy in SAS. And then the CSS that I ship has no math in it. But maybe I'll even, you know what I mean? The SAS is kind of great for stuff like that. But I'm like, I'm not exactly weaning off SAS, but I'm kind of weaning off SAS. You know?
Well, you had that post recently, kind of web development of the future, or the future.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was thinking maybe we'd get into that like the next episode and talk about that. So look forward to that, people. But yeah, I do think that the feature setups, and you've been doing it longer than I have. You're always ahead of the curve, Dave. You've been weaning yourself off CSS preprocessing for longer than I have.
Yeah, well, I'm using it on a project, but yeah, I try to actually use it less. And I really, now that variables are kind of a thing, I don't see... like a lot of the value is getting chipped away, I guess is what I'm saying.
That's the whole point. Preprocessing is great, but you're right. The major features of CSS preprocessing are starting to fall away as we use things like Webpack for the imports and stuff, as variables are here, and as, I don't know. There's no nesting, but there's a bunch of stuff that's just kind of like, yeah.
You can, if you write small enough modules, like the nesting benefit goes away too. Like, so if you're just writing really small CSS files,
yeah, you're way into BEM, you know.
Yeah, like you need it less, I guess. Is
sure. And it's likely that we'll get some kind of extend, and selectors will get more powerful. Maybe we'll even get, or we'll probably get mix-ins of some kind. Variable, like the variable spec is like ready to deal with chunks of things, which just is kind of what a mix-in in, although I don't think it will take parameters, but still, this, whatever, you get it.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there was that, Tab Atkins was working on at apply, which isn't that kind of the include?
It is, it's like, you know how a variable is dash dash foo equal, or foo colon bar or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
But you could go dash dash foo colon and then like curly brackets and then a whole chunk of stuff. Mm-hmm. So your variable isn't just one value anymore, but it's a whole chunk of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that'll go, maybe there'll be some kind of variables that we can start using for something like the width of a media query or something, which you can't do now. Maybe there'll be extend. Again, apply is also extend in a way, which is pretty powerful. Anyway,
it's I think like Tab did blog. He was kind of like, I think I'm done with apply, but I don't know why I abandoned apply, but maybe I didn't read it close enough. So he may just be like, well, there's maybe somebody else can pick it up from here or something. But I didn't really, anyway.
But CSS, we watch it evolve. It's been crazy the last 2 years. Like, some more stuff is coming. It's not like we've had this crazy couple of years of CSS and now CSS will ship nothing. I just don't feel like that's happening. So if we're specifically talking about the future of front-end development, of which, of course, CSS is a part of, if we had to guess, we'd say, okay, the value that preprocessors are bringing is less than you. It's not to say preprocessors couldn't step up and start doing way more cooler, crazier stuff for us, help us modularize, help us do the things that we're reaching to other tools to do. They could, but it's just there's not a lot of evidence of that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we got off track a little bit. Okay, so let's say Calc is now part, I mean, it's been around a while, but now people just kind of no-brainer use Calc, CSS function.
The only place it doesn't really work is Opera Mini at the moment, so, and older IEs.
I guess that could be significant because where you'd use Calc is, isn't, it's not border radius, you know, it's not like where you're using it could be anything. It could be heights and widths and padding and stuff that could be very bad to know.
A lot of layout stuff, but you can also maybe assume Opera Mini is fine with the tube of content. Opera Mini, you know,
right?
It's bad rendering kind of on purpose, so.
Sure, and Calc is sometimes easy to fall back for because you can like guess a value and just put it as the you know the key value thing right above where you're using the Calc one, so it's not so bad to do. You don't have to get too crazy with it. Plus, I imagine it is there some kind of actually as a value, it probably doesn't work with at supports. I don't actually don't know that. Can you do at supports for Calc? Good question. Write in and tell us. Okay, so instead of using SAS for this math for this aspect ratio box, move it to Calc. And I was like, I don't know. I'm a little hungover from the Mr. Big Show, as one is, and gambling. So I'm like, okay, how do you do this in Calc? I need a percentage value. What you can't do is like Calc parentheses and then inside the Calc go like, you know, width divided by height and then put a percentage after the Calc. Like that's how you would do it in SAS, kind of like append the value of the computation to a percentage sign or that doesn't work. One of the values in Calc has to be a percentage. So I was like, okay, so like add two zeros at the end of one of these things and then divide it by the thing and then you end up with the right math. And my head was like, that actually works to divide 447,300 divided by 281 or whatever and you get the right percentage. And then everybody tweets back at me because I think out loud on Twitter sometimes. Everybody tweets back at me like, no, just do 287 divided by 483 or whatever the math is times 100%. Mm-hmm. And then you get the thing. And I think that's nice. It's like a nice way to do a one-off aspect ratio box with the math right in there so that you can see what the math is. And I always like that. Like if you're going to float four boxes to the left so they all fit in a line, doing Calc 100 divided by 4 feels nice. It's nice to see the math sometimes, especially when the resulting value would be a really awful decimal. Just put the Calc right in there and you can see it. It's great.
You know what you could do too, if you're using like WordPress or something, you could kind of do that inline, right? Like you could do a inline style with the like padding top is the height, you know, and fill it up. So there's some cool tricks you can do. Like,
that's true. When it's a one-off in your document, why not use some inline?
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking even like programmatic, like a big hero image on your website, like fill up that gray space before, you know, programmatically draw that first image in your blog post, you know. And
Dave, that's always thinking about performance. What's nice there is it doesn't have to download your style sheet that's blocking and yada yada yada. You get this like aspect ratio box
on the first paint.
On the first paint, baby.
Yeah, that's huge. I start to notice that more and more and more when I visit. You know, I was looking at some e-commerce sites the other day, and it had this really bad push down effect as you'd like browse through the site and the image for each product wasn't there. And as they arrived, it pushed the other stuff below. I'm like, whoa, that seems like the easiest possible scenario that y'all should have just put width and height on the image tags.
I'll share a little link. I wrote about using like intrinsic placeholders with like the picture element. So your picture element is your intrinsic box, you know, and then you just have a source in there and you just use it. What's interesting there, I had a lot of people on Twitter explain I'm using picture incorrectly. Sure, whatever. but funny, no one gave me the same answer. People were like, oh, you should use figure. Oh, you should use div. Oh, you should use a span or something. I just was like, y'all all are smart people and y'all all gave me different answers. So I'm just going to use picture. You can use whatever you want. But there's some good videos of, I did like before, after of this, like adding an intrinsic box of when it loads. And yeah, it was rough before. It like the whole page just like jerk, like spit out as the images came in and resized, and I didn't like it. So, you know, the bigger the images, the bigger your problem is, basically. So, so I've made that little, the boxes, and now it does a lot less thrashing. Like when you turn on the green paint frames in Chrome, I forget how to turn that off, but if you do that in Chrome, it's a lot less like, oh, I got to reflow the whole page because it's just filling up that box. So check that out.
Absolutely. Twitter did that to me too. Of course, it keeps rolling on, and I, you know, aware of some of this stuff, but it's good to reload it in the brain a little bit. Okay, now you have an aspect ratio box, right? Mm-hmm. That's not, the padding top isn't the only way to do that. In fact, a way that became hip and cool to do that is to not apply a padding top right to the parent container, but use a pseudo element, a block level pseudo element inside of it to do mm-hmm. it. Because mm-hmm. then you have this box that isn't a locked height. The height is pushed that high from the pseudo element, meaning that if you accidentally or on purpose or whatever put more content in there than can fit, you have a box that will grow. Which is nice, right? Because it sucks to have set heights in web design. That's like number one code smell, CSS problematic stuff.
Yeah, the height zero is yeah.
So I should shout out to Lissy Linhart, who then tweeted, like, you should check out ratiobuddy.com, which then does that. So you have two numbers. You chuck the two numbers in this little web app, and it gives you a chunk of CSS. It's nested, so apparently I assume Sass or Nest, with the pseudo element ready to go for you there.
That's cool. Ratio Buddy?
Ratio Buddy. It looks like pretty well done little one-off web app that gives you that little chunk of code for an aspect ratio box, safe one. Yeah. And then of what was it? Tommy Hodgkins, who always rolls in with his like JavaScript and CSS stuff, which I always think is so fascinating. But he writes these little plugins that like, you know, they're a little. It's not post CSS, but it feels like it. You know, like an invented CSS syntax. I don't know. You'll have to see this one, but it allows you to write dash dash aspect ratio and just drop it in there. And it does the same thing, but of course it's done with JavaScript at runtime. So
So you have a variable and then you just set the variable at some point and then blam, things work.
Yeah. Actually, that's maybe cool. It's not JavaScript in this case, but Tommy's known for the interpolate JavaScript or CSS with JavaScript and do fancy things world. So
Tommy's like, let's just use WebAssembly to do this.
I can do some cool stuff though. It started with that like EQ CSS and like, let's do, what do you container queries in it kind of thing. But then it was like, well, now that we have this power, we might as well use it for everything. Somebody also mentioned that calc, like, I don't know how you feel about this. Are you asking the browser to do a lot more work when you don't pre-process these calculations? You just leave them in calc? And I was like, no way does that feel right. Like, how much work is asking a computer to do one math problem?
I'm sure there's a millisecond, microsecond hit, but like, yeah, we work on computers, folks. They do math. That's their own job.
Like, is it like gigaflops and all those numbers they use for preprocessors? How many math problems it can do per microsecond or whatever? Millions or something. It just seems to me that can't. But I know that it's more complicated than that or whatever, so don't at me. But
I mean, if you had like a calc-based whole web page, it's probably rough. But I don't think, you know, I don't think there's a huge concern there. Yeah. You know, your paint time may take more, or your layout calculation may take more because it's like probably has to evaluate the layout and then calculate something. But I wouldn't worry about it.
My favorite tweet, though, was the guy who was like, I thought this tweet was from 2 years ago. This is what we were talking about then. Now. Nice,
dude. You went uncutting edge. That's your sin. Like, that was your sin, Chris.
Okay. Admittedly, a tiny bit hungover, but I think it's okay to talk about something that's ever been talked about before.
Can we go super tangent here? Is this okay? This is our podcast. So I'm reading this book called The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt.
I've heard of this.
It's, and I was tipped off by Mike Industries.
Davidson?
Davidson, yeah, does he his last name that industries? Mike Davidson, he's blogging. He's reading kind of he's reading five books. That's hey, these books are the best books on conservatism. Are the best books on liberalism. And he's kind of just like, I'm going to read the five like keystone books of these, reading lists, and I'm going to report on them. And one of them was this book, and the whole book is about kind of understanding the differences between right and left. And I feel like for me, I'm kind of a moderate person, and so I don't like the extreme climates of our political system right now. So again, this is not a politics podcast, but what's interesting is he starts it out from this moral psychology standpoint, and just the humans, like, we are born with this, or we're maybe not born, but I don't know yet. But like, we humans have developed this ability to have this moral mind, this being right in being righteous or self-righteous. Like, we developed that for survival. You know, our in-group, our little, tribe, decided, oh, we don't eat this animal, so therefore people who do are bad, and so it's a really cool book. And I'm just getting into it, but I'm just devouring it. So it's a really cool book, just kind of on the, how we develop these opinions and these strong formed, this is right, this is wrong, react is bad, because it puts CSS in line. And it's been really cool to me to see, or just even apply this stuff to web design or whatever. It just this need to be right all the time is built into people, and that's why Twitter sucks. And so it's cool. It's turning
into even a Dave Rupert talk from not long ago, or I think one of your, correct me if I'm wrong, but you had a slide that was can we just let people be wrong sometimes?
Yeah, that was my Art of Being Wrong talk at CSS DevConf.
I think about that all the time. When somebody says something wrong, just let them be wrong. Somebody's going to catch them, or they'll catch themselves or something, but it's really not a good look and not particularly effective to just be correcting people all the time.
Yeah, that tropey, someone's wrong on the internet, XKCD comic, sure. It's just what if you don't fix it? What if you don't fix somebody's problem? Do you still have a good day? I bet you do. So I don't know. I think it's all about just leveling up the discourse. That's kind of what the whole talk is. It's just kind of leveling up the discourse and trying to, instead of these hot takes or gut reactions or kind of just saying things that you think are true, try to start, soft commit ideas, and then, have a discussion about it, not just a factoid based, I use factoid in the air quotes thing. We all think we're just delivering facts, hamburger menus are bad, and it's Google, Microsoft, Apple all use them. So they're maybe not super bad, or it's maybe not ideal, but it still works. So I don't know. Anyway,
would you say that something about this will change?
Hi-yo!
Our next question from Jesse Angelo. I was trying to look for a Ace. Really nice. I wanted to get your thoughts on the CSS will change property. It's not something I've used since I hadn't heard about it until last week. There's some he quotes from the MDN. The will change CSS property provides a way for authors to hint browsers about the kinds of changes to be expected on an element so that the browser can set up appropriate optimizations ahead of time before the element is actually changed. These kind of optimizations can increase the responsiveness of a page by doing potentially expensive work ahead of time. Okay. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that I know about this and I've dabbled, never to incredible results, as I just don't know what I'm doing enough to notice or something, or I had, or I was trying to solve some jank and tried it and it didn't work kind of thing. Like, I've always been a little nervous about using it because I'm not sure that I'm doing it right. Then part of this story became some articles came out that said, don't just plop this in your CSS. In fact, almost never do that. The way that you should use this is always to apply it through JavaScript wherever on the element that you're about to use it, then trigger the thing that's it's going to need it, then rip it out. And I was always like, ugh, really? That's how we need to use this thing? Even though it's in CSS, why is it in CSS at all if that's how we need to use it? And so it kind of like turned me off on it, and I haven't looked at it really since then. So I don't know where Will Change sits today. Do you use it?
So I had to use it recently. Okay. I was like, so I was animating an element, and you know, and I just was like, is this, you know, like I'm resizing it like on scroll or whatever, and I was just like, okay, how bad is this? You know, I just was like, how bad is this? So I went into Chrome and I clicked the little shish kebab menu in my dev tools and went to rendering and then clicked on paint flashing. This is that those green paint. Yeah. That like where it shows your page kind of.
I know what you're
out.
Talking about. I don't often do it, but I
know. No, you probably don't often do it. But like, so it's anytime your page like animates or something, it like you have a, you just do these paint triangles, or these paint, sorry, blocks, because everything's square in web. So the will change is basically to say like, hey, this is going to change. Like I fade in the opacity on this eventually. So, you know, or I transform this, I scale it up to like 100%, or I move it across the page or something like that. And different browsers will kind of do different things. But kind of the first version, I think Chrome would like make a bitmap, like a basically they would hot swap your element, turn it into like a PNG, and then just move the PNG across the page, because that was easier than moving a bunch of text and image and everything across the page. And it may still do that, like kind of rasterize that little piece of text, that little piece of DOM, so that it can do things really efficiently. What's interesting about Will Change is it's not supported in Edge. And you may be like, classic Microsoft idiots. But they don't need it. Edge does not need it. The way Edge is built, like it does all the okay. Like the will change like interpolation. It does all that automatically. So this is like,
which is what the that's the chorus when this thing dropped to the world was a bunch of developers saying, can't browsers know about this stuff? And then you know, spec people and browser people firing back. That's the whole point, is the browser can't know. You have to tell it.
Yeah.
So I don't know how Edge solved it, but apparently it turns out it was solvable.
Yeah. So it was solvable, but it's you know, it's a hard problem. It's at like the paint layering level, you know, and like you start cracking open that file and you're just asking for,
I wonder if how they solved it, if they solved it in some kind of really ingenious way. I mean, we should say that's the reason why responsive images exists, is it's this elaborate way for you to tell the browser all about these images that you got before, you know, because otherwise it would have to download them to know. And if once it's downloaded them, it's like, wow, crap, we just took the performance hit already. So if there was some kind of fancy way for it to know about those things, you know, and maybe there is, because I know there's client hints is always kind of dropping. Maybe servers could be configured to send better metadata along with things that will start making the complication of responsive images go away. I feel like the responsive images people all along were like, this is a baby step towards what we need. This will evolve as things evolve. It's not the end all answer. It's almost too bad that we have to do all this work.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're doing a lot of work in markup, but I think we need to do a lot of it to get the like, I, as an author, want to define how this page lays out and looks. You know, I don't want to just surrender everything to the browser. So, so I think will change is a bit of a stopgap in order to say, like, hey, this thing's going to animate in, or this thing's going to move, or, you know, I think about if you animate on scroll, you know, a lot, and you got little, you know, doodads flying in left and right, you're probably going to want to use will change to get the most out of the browser, just so that it can say, hey, like, I'm going to move this thing. You just give, it's like giving a browser a heads up that something is going to just basically thrash the page, and then that's going to kind of go, like, going to affect it. So the way you fix it, or like the way you, like, I guess you don't really know what's going to thrash the page, but, you know, that's where that green paint thing comes on in the rendering tab of Chrome, is you just, you have to turn that on and be like, and scroll. And if you're just scrolling naturally, or, you know, I'm using scroll because that's what we do most of the time. But, you know, if you hover something, or if you, you know, click something and something flies in, like a hamburger menu or something like that, and something, you know, it's like this, it really intense, like the whole page turns green and it's all, everything's just kind of like seizing up, then you're going to want to use will change to basically on the layer that's kind of moving, just so you can kind of say, hey, this guy is going to cause some intense layout calculations. So, and it was originally like a hack to throw things on the GPU as opposed to the CPU. Because most of your website and JavaScript are on the CPU, and will change, I think, was sort of a hack to replace that transform 3D 000.
Right.
So it was kind of a hack.
That was the thing. It was like, that was literally a hack. It was like, apply a nothing transform just to trick it into using the GPU.
Yeah. So it'll use the GPU, which is just, you know, it's just
assuming your computer has one, I guess. Is it just assumed? I feel like I remember a day when computers didn't necessarily have a graphic.
Yeah, I mean, there was something that rendered graphics, but they know, like, I mean, this is like the late 90s, but ever since then, you know, your computer probably has a integrated GPU. Your CPU has an integrated GPU. That's what's in most laptops, and, you know, the, like, Apple laptops have a, you know, a integrated NVIDIA, or I think it's a Radeon GPU now, or maybe they have a separate GPU. So, but most, you know, I don't know, most CPUs have an integrated GPU. And then there's a, yeah, beyond that, or maybe it's motherboards have a GPU. Anyway, but yeah, you get a dedicated GPU, mm-hmm. and that is kind of where the superpower comes in.
So it looks like, still useful, still a little confusing. If somebody knows a lot about this or has used it a lot and feels knowledgeable about it, please write to me at team@cssTricks.com and write a guest post for me about what I always like is like real world recipes for will change, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. That would be nice. And then show us some before and after of where you didn't use it and it sucked, and then you did use it and it's good. Maybe there's stuff like that out there. I can look around, but happy to publish that for you. We pay.
Money.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by the very cool .tech domains. So maybe till about 5 years ago, it's pretty hard to get a website URL that was really like short and brandable because the, you know, the domain name market was so super saturated then. So 5 years ago, what becomes available is all this new slew of, you know, top level domains that came available. Today, you can choose a non.com website, really nice because there's so many extensions available, including .tech, a domain extension exclusively for the tech community. It's pretty cool to get like your name.tech if you're in the tech space. You know, if you're a business, .tech website is better because it's like it helps you build and connect your target audience immediately, like if you are a tech-like company. So as I say, there's two websites, foodstamp.com, foodstamp.tech. You already know that foodstamp.tech is about combining food and technology. You just know that by the URL automatically, which is kind of cool. Another big benefit is you can really, really shorten your URL. Viacomtech.com becomes Viacom.tech. You know, shorter, sleeker, nicer, better. Last month, Hollywood.tech went live. You don't even need to guess. It's about connecting Hollywood and technology. Very cool. Check it out. So, you know, tech events, tech startups, hackathons, tech clubs, all increasingly choosing .tech to stand out, which is pretty cool. So what are you waiting for? Shop Talk Show listeners get a year of .tech domain for only $4.99, which is pretty great. So that's at get.tech. Of course, they use a .tech domain to buy them. Get.tech. And use coupon code SHOPTALK to get that. $4.99 for a year and $49.99 for 10 years. Pretty cool. Thanks, .tech. We've made it through one question in half an hour.
Hey, we're doing good. What a good episode. Hey, taking the rapid out of rapid fires here. Oliver Williams writes in, I'm trying to improve my JavaScript skills. I've been learning promises and reading about the Fetch API and would really like to practice with it. I'd like to play around with APIs, but it always seems like a huge hassle to register for an API key when I just want to have quick practice. Well, what are the best APIs to experiment with as a novice JS developer?
This seems very deja vu. I think we'd probably not... super long ago, but we did one of these. Like, what are free APIs to use? Here's a great link. This is the only link you need. github.com/ToddMotto/public-APIs. And there's a shucks load of them in there.
Yeah, you like anime? Boom, three anime APIs. Booyah. You like beer? I think there's a beer API. You like, environment, the environment. Yeah, there's
and then remember that like GitHub itself has it. You know, back in the day, Flickr was a popular one to play with, although I'm not sure how good it is anymore. And then there's what like maybe steer clear of ones like the Instagram API, which is super locked out and weird and auth ready and has a bunch of limitations. Look for one that's more fun, you know? And if you're into content, you know, that WordPress ships with the JSON APIs now just out of the box. So you could play, probably without even asking, you could hit some random WordPress site's API and play with their content a little bit or spin up a WordPress site yourself for that kind of thing. And that's a nice, you know, nice JSON API.
Yeah. I mean, you just, yeah, you, like this actually lists by auth, like does it have auth or, you know, so if you have need an API key, so choose one without an API key. You can also, I think from most Twitter apps or even through Twitter, you can download your tweets or something and like just download your tweets and put it in a directory and then fetch that file, that JSON file. Don't do like the 40 meg one, but just like, you know, get a sample of tweets and then like go fetch your localhost file. Like you be the API. So, you can like, you don't have to fetch from an API exactly. You can like go fetch, you know, a file. So fetch one of your own files and do something with it. Just iterate through it and play with it. And yeah, do that.
I shouldn't say used to, because I absolutely still do have a website, quotesondesign.com. There's a little API link in the bottom right corner too that's got a little API for you to play with too. Anyway, go for it. It's fun. JSON APIs are the future, of course. They have been for a long time. It's particularly cool how well they work with new JavaScript.
Yeah. Well, and if you have a WordPress site, you can turn on the like WordPress JSON API thing.
That's what I was saying. You don't even have to turn it on. Just
it's there. Yeah. There you go. And like you could just start querying your website. You're like friend's website or your client's website. Shh, don't tell them. Anyway, all right. Mikey Michelson writes in, I was wondering if you and anybody know if Chrome DevTools works will for doing CSS in the inspector and saving to a file, mm-hmm. preferably with SAS. So does Chrome DevTools save to a file?
It totally does. And this is another article I've been trying to commission because I don't actually do it. I feel like I could make it work, but I don't. It's not part of my day-to-day workflow, but it is for some people. I feel like even Remy Sharp had some early stuff in this regard. But yeah, you crack open the dev tools and it's like, it's the sources tab that is for this, not so much like the elements. You can't just like go in and target an H1 and like change the name of it in the DOM inspector and save that out to a file. That's the rendering of the DOM, and you'll never be able to like save that to a file, at least not in a useful way. It's more about that sources tab in which that lists things like your CSS, and you can look at like the actual shipped CSS that came to the browser, and you can click into there and change it. And then there's some kind of, you like right click it, and then you say, I don't know, save as, and it'll ask you like, okay, where is this? Because it doesn't know where on your file system that thing is. Like, you need to map it once, but once you've mapped it, it'll remember where it is, and then you can just hit save. So yes, you can edit it in there, and I feel like what you could then have a map, right, that maps to your SAS. So I think there's some way to get your SAS to show up in the sources tab somehow, some way, mm-hmm. and then you can edit that, and then because it's saving to your file system, your Gulp Watch or your Webpack dev server or your Gulp Watch or whatever, so any, you know, browser sync or something is watching that file system, and it's saving it just like it would be saving it out of Atom or Sublime or Visual Studio Code or whatever. And then it triggers the build, it injects the new stuff, the sources panel updates. Like, there is a way to use Chrome DevTools or other DevTools, presumably, to be your replacement text editor. I mean, it's a code mirror instance in there, so there's syntax highlighting and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you can totally do it. You can do it. I'm looking at a bunch. I just, you know, Chrome DevTools edit SAS, and I got quite a few articles. But I want to say, I watched that Paul Irish at Google I.O. 2017 talk, and I want to say he had some kind of new announcements on this, like,
oh, really?
Like better compat. So I need to maybe remember better, but I don't.
It sounds appealing in that, I don't know, you give up a lot. It's not Vim in here. There's no Emmet in here. There's no Git sidebar in here. There's lots of stuff that you give up, but what you get is no software. It's all happening right in your browser, which seems appealing to me. And it seems appealing to me in the same way that Vim appeals to some people, in that it's just like this default experience in so many places. You know, a lot of people like not using software or using as little software as they can.
Yeah.
I get it. It seems cool. Write an article about it for CSS Tricks.
Hey, this podcast is brought to you by CSS Tricks. Yeah. Want to write articles for CSS Tricks? All right. You want to do the next one here? Or we got time, right?
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. We're only 40 minutes into this thing.
You're not even to work, dear listener.
I love this one because I've been thinking about it a lot, even though it's, I don't know. Actually, no, whatever. Jacob Harris writes in, do you guys ever use mail:: links, you know, rather than like HTTP links? You know, you've all seen it, like an anchor link that the href starts with mail:: and then DaveRupert@DaveRupert.dave or whatever mm-hmm, Dave's mail is. So when you click it, the browser, and the, I guess that's the question mark, like what does the browser do in those? I think a lot of us are used to it, I don't know, opening up your native email client or something like that. So Jacob writes, I like the idea, but I find the result jarring and inconsistent. They often open an app that isn't the browser. Sometimes they do nothing at all if the user doesn't have a default email client set up, for example. Is there a use case for mail:: at all, or should I just avoid them? And I think it's a good question. It's like, what is the best practice with these dang things? I'll pass it to you in a second, but I would say, yeah, either avoid them or have it be designed so obviously of what it is. Like, there's a big email icon right next to it, or it says, like, you know, this is a mail link, click it to, you know, have it behave like an AI, like make it clear. What I really hate is like, there's like some fancy designer site and it's like about RFP contact and they're all styled exactly the same. And, but the contact one is a mail:: link.
Like, yeah.
You tricked me. I hate those. I do have my browser configured to open Gmail in the browser, because that's what I use.
See, yeah, I was going to ask, how does that work? If you're web Gmail and you click a mail:: what happens?
By default, it won't it'll fail. It'll open something else.
It'll open like your Apple Mail, and then you're like, ah, hell.
Yeah, and I'm sure it does something similar on Windows, right? It'll open Outlook or whatever you use.
Yeah, I bet it opens, Outlook or something, or mail.app. So
is there mail.app on?
Oh yeah, I use mail.app and it's budget, but it's great. I love it. I can change the color. I can murder out my web client, my mail client, Chris.
Oh, really?
Oh yeah. Just go dark mode. Boom, murdered. Huh. That's great.
And it's just like Microsoft ships it default with Windows.
Yeah, it's basically like Outlook, the web the React app, I guess, but it's like Outlook, and it's cool. It's got all the kind of Outlook for iOS features too. It's pretty.
I heard people really like that.
I'm telling you, it's pretty good. Mm-hmm. Pretty good, folks. I just use that. The rendering is not so great. I will. It doesn't have WebKit to render. It uses some weird,
like the Microsoft Word engine or whatever they joke about.
So it's bad. But anyway. Hey, it's, I don't care.
Okay, so it opens up that, let's say, and let's say you don't use that. That would be obnoxious, and it definitely is obnoxious. And people know how to do email, right? So if you just list your email on your website somehow that's not a link, they'll copy it and use it. It's just a pet peeve of mine to assume that people are so stupid that, they'll never be able to figure out how to send an email if I don't have a mail to link in here. It's just one of those arguments that I just don't want to have. Like, just put your email there. People will figure it out. Oh my God. And I think even the days of obfuscating emails is a little ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, that's a thing you have to be concerned about is if you put a mail to on your website, you are just asking to get listed by a spam bot. Like, a bot's going to crawl you. It's going to put your name on their little mailing list and bingo bango.
Sure. I would just assume that all emails are compromised anyway, though. For the most
That's
part.
True. Yeah. I mean, I'm on so many lists. I don't even check my spam.
I don't know. I don't know. This has become, isn't this a joke on some other podcast? I get no spam. But anyway, I use Gmail and I literally never get any spam. So whatever. And I plastered my email address everywhere.
Yeah.
Okay. That's an aside, but I would say UX wise, a little jarring. There is some little tricksy thing, and I forget what it is. Example. I think you got to go into the console in Chrome or something and set something, or it's an about.flag or something. There's some kind of cool little trick in Chrome, at least. And I hope and assume, I guess, that there's ways to do it for other browsers too, it's like an internal browser thing that says when a mail to link is clicked, do this instead. Like, do nothing or open a Gmail tab for me instead. And I think even in Chrome with Gmail, it's still not great. I think it pops open a thing, like a little ad window looking thing, only it's a client. It doesn't like move over to the tab and open a new email within that tab. It's not even that nice.
So it doesn't, it just does. Yeah. Anyway, I would say just don't, or I don't know.
Shop talk show law, put it in the books. Don't use them.
Don't.
That's too much. Of course, there's gray area with everything, but it's fun to just pick an answer sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Pierce, I'll zoom in. Pierce Morgan writes in recently, I've been reading a lot about styled components, i.e. the latest cool kid on the block is CSS and JavaScript. There's a lot of suggestion that you can and should use JavaScript to replace your preprocessor's functionality. For example, the other day I read an article where the JavaScript was used to dynamically construct a CSS typographical scale based on a golden ratio. Aha. Okay. But pretty cool stuff. But my question is, does it make sense to execute this on the client side? I realize that this alone is a very small calculation for the browser to handle. But if you take this approach, your entire app, surely you risk a performance hit sooner or later. By losing the pre-compilation step, you're surely forfeiting the optimization one. Also, ultimately, this isn't an example of the inner platform effect, which is a link to something from Wikipedia. Hopefully it's not salacious, but no. So inter-platform effect, I'm not familiar with this, so I'll have to kind of bone up on that.
Okay. So just to back up a little, I know you're on vacation, so I wonder if you missed this. No, it says May 22nd. You weren't on vacation yet then, but maybe you missed this article. And if you haven't, I would say really just pop your feet up on the couch and read every word of this, because it's Mark, sorry if I'm going to screw this up, Dalgleish. posted an article on Medium called A Unified Styling Language. And I would recommend that every single person on Shop Talk Show reads every word of this journey that he lays out that's about CSS and JavaScript. And so what I'd like to say first is that we did a show on Shop Talk Show when this was in its first round of being a hot topic. And I thought it was a pretty good show, actually. Mm-hmm, and it was worth listening to. We had a good debate about CSS and JavaScript and habit. Since that almost is, I almost don't even recommend you listen to it anymore. I mean, you can, and I think you might get something out of it, whatever. But it's not the conversation anymore. The conversation has changed a lot since then. And now there's a lot more tools. And in this question, Piers opens up with styled components. That's one part of this story. There's modular CSS or CSS modules. That's a different part of this story. There's glamorous. That's a different part of this story. There's a lot of big projects that have come along to have their say in how this CSS and JavaScript could go down. And so calling it inline styles like we were doing for a minute, that's kind of even out now. We don't really think of them in that way anymore. A lot more of these projects are not live interpolation of styles like Piers is talking about, although that's possible that you can do that. It's not totally, you know, baby bathwater or whatever. Most of these newer, cooler, hipper ways, I'd say, to handle this actually generate real CSS that ships with your project, which I think everybody's starting to agree with. Yes, CSS is good. We're going to use that, but it's created through JavaScript.
Right. So you write like a JavaScript array, and it will create a style tag, basically, like with all your...
Maybe even a real CSS file, but yeah, maybe a style tag.
If you're using Node on the server, you could obviously split it out.
And you get all this stuff, like it's scoped. Like you don't have to name anything, for example, because it's being applied right to it. Like some projects are like that, or maybe there are classes created for it, but they're automatically scoped so that they handle that, you know, the modularity of CSS in a way. Because that's part of this argument, right, is the I don't know. I always call it the I'm afraid of my style sheet thing, although people, that hasn't really...
I like that. I'm afraid of my style sheet. I'm working on one of those. I'm helping fix a giant CSS file. So, yeah.
So I'm not even doing this justice at all. Believe me. Please read this article. We'll put it in the show notes, and it covers so much of this ground, and will really level up, I think, your thinking on what this, you know, CSS and JavaScript thing is. And it absolutely seems like the future of CSS to some degree for me. Not saying that every project in the world needs this. I'm absolutely not saying that. I probably will write just normal old style sheets with my fingers for a long time, depending on the project. But if I was kicking off a new fairly large project, I would reach for new JavaScript. I would reach for React and stuff. I would still try to server render it if I could. I would reach for one of these tools for the CSS for it, for all of the things that it brings to the party, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, I think this is all to bridge the like JS to CSS gap. Like how do you, like, if you're writing heaps of JavaScript, it probably doesn't make sense to maintain a separate style sheet, like if you're doing everything in JavaScript. So from that perspective, now you need a JavaScript way to spit out a style sheet. And that's kind of what these are sort of doing. Or like he recommends a thing called Styletron, which looks pretty cool. And I saw some Google people talking about it as like, this is actually a pretty great API for doing this or something. So, but it has a hit too. It's like 100 and something K of, or 12K gzipped, you know. So, you know, there's parse and execution time. So, it's not all panacea, folks. So, but there's also this cool, you know, Sketch is now doing JavaScript. And so now there's like this, you can like pair React and Sketch and all this stuff.
That stuff's insane.
I mean, isn't that kind of wild? I mean, I still don't trust like design tools to spit out HTML. That's like my Dreamweaver days, but you know it. What
well says the guy who's done a production project in Webflow.
I have used Production Project and Webflow, and it was kind of all right. I use Webflow is neat because it was like, I'm pretty stingy or stodgy about it, but it was like, hey, this, like, I don't hate this. Like, it's pretty close to how I would write it. So, you know, and that was more about meeting the client's demand to update every piece of text on the website. And I was like, well, I'm not going to write all that WordPress code. So here you go. Here's a thing that does it. So anyway, this is cool. Anyway, yeah, I just kind of cruised this thing, this talk, or this this kind of, what is this, a long read? So I need to read it. So
I perused it at first too, and then I just was in like one of those where I think I was literally waiting for my luggage at the airport, and I'm like, I'm gonna read that thing again, and I just like read every word of it. I was like, this is,
I'm gonna add it to my Microsoft Edge read later list, and I'll pick it up on my tablet later. Haha, I win. All right, we got time for one more. You want to let's wrap it up. Yeah. I think we got a bunch of questions. We'll be back next week with another rapid fire. So thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to star, heart, favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. We really appreciate y'all listening, and hope you've enjoyed this season. We've really enjoyed it. I think we're still going, but we've had some cool shows, Chris. It's been really, really good. So if you missed some, yeah, go back and listen to kind of the last month or two has been really, really great. So, if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs, get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you have anything else to say to them?
Shoptalkshow.com.